Hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David. Since the pandemic hit and made touring and performing impossible, I've taken to broadcasting interviews with people I can't visit in person anymore. They're live streamed most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT on various platforms, including the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance and KABU Community Radio here in Portland, Oregon. All these interviews then go up in podcast form afterwards, which you can find if you look up This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform or just go to davidrovics.com. I also do a live concert from my living room on the last Saturday of each month at 1 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. GMT. Today, we're spending the hour with Rory Waterman, talking to us from his home in Nottingham, England, where he is a senior lecturer in English and creative writing. Rory has published several books of his own wonderful poetry on Carcanet Press, Tonight the Summer's Over, Sarajevo Roses, and most recently, just last May, Sweet Nothings. Rory, welcome to my little live stream show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I like your, I was saying the same before, I like your black backdrop, your special curtained in sort of room. It looks like you're in a void. Whereas I've got a stain. I've got a stain on the wall.
You've got the stained wall. Yeah.
It's not where I lean. It looks like it's where I lean my head, you know, it looks like an old man's bed or something, but it's not, I swear.
If you raised up the screen, then it would be a different angle, but it's, that's a fine angle. I had this curtain in the living room for having house guests, because we don't have a guest room, but at least we could provide a little visual privacy when, for people on the couch.
Like someone visiting a hospital.
Yeah, it's like visiting a hospital, right? And we barely ever used it for that purpose, but it makes a great studio anyway.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, good. Anyway.
Rory, I want to get you to read some poems for us, but could we start out with reading a poem, perhaps?
Yeah, all right. Okay. you caught me on the hop. Sorry. I'm going to try and share the screen.
Yeah, let's experiment with screen share.
So, this one will be no good for your podcast.
That's okay.
They can hear. But they can enjoy the silence, the moment of quiet. Share screen. I don't know if this is going to work, so I'm not going to do it.
It could probably work. It'll pop up on my screen that there's something to share if you click that share screen.
And share entire screen share. No, it's just not letting me do it.
Oh, okay.
I apologize.
They don't need to see it anyway. They can find it on the web. It's all there. RoryWaterman.com. They can find lots of links to poems and books of poetry. Yeah.
You can. And this one's actually there. This one was in Poetry Review about 8 months ago or something. Excellent. So this poem's it's in my new book, Sweet Nothings. And it's called Like Father. And if I appear to be glaring through you, it's because I'm reading it.
You're reading
it
on the screen.
I'm not a performance.
So it's not the thousand mile gaze, kind of like
like when you've been driving or something. You're just staring. Yeah, it's not that. So the poem's called Like Father. So I was born in Belfast, and I grew up in England. My parents separated when I was two, and my mum moved to my grandmother's house. And my aunt lived there and my cousin lived there as well in a three-bedroomed house. And my grandmother slept on a chair in the living room and died too soon. She was great. She was wonderful. She was like a second mother to me. And I had quite a complicated relationship with my dad. So this is quite a solipsistic poem, actually. He is a very difficult man. And he's a poet as well, actually. So that runs in the family. In other ways, he's taught me a lot about how not to be, I'd like to think. When I was about 18 or something, I tried to write a lot of poems. I'm sure you did the same, David. I'm sure we all did, and I'm sure they were shite, and that's no discredit to you, but that's totally kind of what happened to me.
Absolutely. I still have notebooks that were saved in my mother's attic that she mailed to me. And I was reading about how you were going through your old stuff when you were 18 and rewriting a lot of the stuff you started. That's a neat idea, because there's always some great little lines and stuff. And I mean, I find some really great lines. Nothing complete from when I was young that's any good, but some great lines.
Right. Yeah. Well, I had a real kind of awakened social conscience when I was about 15. My grandmother died, and the little lodge house we'd lived in, it was her. We thought it was her house, so we thought it was our house, but it didn't. It belonged to this big farm estate, Nocton Farm Estates, which is now owned by Dyson. And they reclaimed the house straight away. So we had a month to get out and to find council housing, what you call social housing. So I was biking around all over the other villages looking at this housing, and then ringing my mum up from phone boxes and saying, this one looks okay. And of course, now you couldn't do that. Now you'd be in a bed and breakfast for I don't know how long. You wouldn't really have that kind of dignity, but we could move into social housing, to council housing.
Without any 5-year wait or anything?
No, yeah, because I was a kid still. I was 15.
Ah, that's right.
So, yeah. And I don't think that would be the case now. But I can't really get into what I did to get my own back on the bastards who took her house away. But I probably shouldn't get into that. But
it might get you in trouble. I got my revenge. Limitations. Yeah.
There's a lot you can do with a hammer in the dead of night.
Absolutely. Very good. Everybody should know that. A hammer, a pickaxe, there's incredible tools. A wrench, really a lot.
That's right. And any of it will do. I mean, even your hands if you have to, you know, your head or something. So I wrote some of these poems around that time, sort of 16, 17, 18. And then like you, rather than my mum sending it to me, I visited my mother's house and I went into a drawer full of all my kind of old crap. And discovered these kind of mawkish poems, "Mummy doesn't love me" kind of poems, and I found this among a sort of nascent version of this amongst it, and I decided, okay, I'm going to do something with that now and implant myself at twice that age on top of that self then, looking back at my childhood. So that's what I did. The explanation's been a lot longer than the poem. The poem's called "Like Father." Started 2000, finished 2019 for WC. My daddy was Irish and famous. Well, sort of Irish and sort of famous, he said, and told the truth. He loved and he was loved and was a joker. And in his youth, he passed the 11 plus with such high marks they'd sent him to private school, plush lawns, straw hats. But then he'd felt oppressed by the Oxbridge conveyor. So that was that for years, while he wrote in garrets and took real jobs. Porter on Jersey, bank clerk. He explored the world and then read English up at Leicester, then at Oxford, and won awards and found he was getting in prints, but still worked summers at Leicester Station Goods Yard. Am I as bright as you, Daddy? Probably not. So it was hard not to pine for all he represented on access visits, and not to be beguiled, but I knew I wasn't as special. That I was an anxious child who liked to play with marbles on his own while mum cooked, watched EastEnders, tidied up, who teachers said should come out of his shell, who had a pup and made her his best friend and got in trouble for daydreaming and caused too much of a fuss about his distant dad, who scrapped, who failed the 11 plus and went to a comprehensive where he learned never to try too hard, who knew his place was in the middle, who watched his lurch drunk father jab at the face of a steadfast woman patently too good to stay with him. She didn't. Who wouldn't become a poet and scholar too, or much at all. He was too dumb. Who later found the custody hearing documents while helping his mother clear her musty attic. The affidavits of all his dad's ex-lovers, each emphatic that I'm sure the child's interests are best served by being kept from this abusive man, a drunk who bullied and hit me. His arrest statement from when my nan lost her front teeth. I hadn't been told the reason. Until then, I'd seen one short, partial report to which my father had clung. Mum had buried most retorts, and Nan was now in her functional little urn. And I was trying to be like him, a bit, in fewer and fewer ways, and started a poem. And this is it.
Mm. Damn, man.
So that's that.
That's fantastic. You know, I mean, every one of your poems, actually, without exception, which is probably not at all accidental, because otherwise they don't make it into your books, I suspect. But every one of them, when you pay attention and read it without distraction, like poems are supposed to be read, I would add as a caveat, like not like while the TV's on in the background, but if you're really paying attention and you read any one of your poems, there's this, I mean, what always impresses me, and also just about great poetry generally, is how much it evokes such an intense emotional response in me, and I assume in other readers, I'm sure. But the economy of words, I mean, that poem was one of your longer poems, actually.
Yeah,
right? It is.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There are only sort of two or three that are as long as that or longer than that. Yeah.
But yeah. even so, I mean, it's still like half the length of your average song, right? I mean, in terms of like performance time, you know?
Yeah, and that's right. Like,
The economy of words that what got, I mean, it's such a annoying question when I get asked this question, how did you get started into playing music, you know? But what was it that about this particular form of writing, I mean, aside from your father being a poet, got you into it? Or was that, I mean, I guess your father being a poet would have been a massive driver in that direction, because it was obviously something you were familiar with, like
That's exactly it. Yeah. Like, okay. Yeah. So there we go. Yeah. So I think that's partly it. I mean, I didn't grow up with my dad, at all. He lived in Ireland. And it's a very good job I didn't grow up with him. Because he was kind of a quite abusive drunk. But certainly I was aware, unusually aware of poetry as an option, something that existed in the world. And I remember him buying me books. I've got a copy of Shane Massini's selected poems with, you know, From Dad 1994 written on it or something. So he was trying to encourage me to read poetry. The thing is, like, I was a rebellious kid, and most kids are, right? I wasn't going to do what my parents wanted me to do. And I was growing kind of aware that I certainly didn't want to be like him. But I was very aware of poetry as a thing. And I read a lot and I listened to a lot of music, and I was always very interested in words and the way words can be put together and the way they can evoke things, not directly or through metaphor or connotation. And there are some great songwriters who hugely, obviously, it's Joe Strummer's birthday today, right? 68, I think today he would have been. I mean, the lyrics of The Clash were kind of hugely influential to me as a kid, and they still sort of are. I mean, you know, there's
did you get into punk rock? At an early age, punk rock was a big
influence? Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I got into metal, right? Metal, because I was you know, I liked anything that was loud and aggressive sounding. And when I was sort of about 11 or 12, and then from there I kind of became increasingly interested in punk rock. Yeah, so and The Clash and the Stiff Little Fingers and all these bands that I'd missed, you know, I couldn't mm-hmm. really kind of go see them live. Or I suppose with the Stiff Little Fingers I could and did, but like generally speaking, I couldn't. They didn't really exist anymore. But that was the kind of world of music I inhabited.
You were born in 1981, so you're born sort of a few years into the,
born too late.
The punk rock. Yeah,
I'm born too late. That's right. Yeah, I mean,
I always thought I was born too late, being born in '67 too. You know?
No. The luckiest, in terms of the generation of music they grew up around, the luckiest person that I know that you know is Attila, right? John Bain.
Yeah, he was born at the right time.
Oh fuck yeah, absolutely.
The punk rock phenomenon.
Yeah, that's when it all happened. So. So I was very aware of kind of the way you could, and I'm quite good with words, with the written word and thinking my way through things and kind of presenting complexities and keeping them open to complexity. And I think with songwriting, tell me if I'm wrong, like I don't really believe in generalizations, which is a generalization itself. But I think in general terms, with a song, I don't really particularly like the term protest song. It just sort of seems like a box to put things in. But with music about things, particularly if they're political things, you can be quite on the nose, right? You don't have to deal in subtleties in the same ways. You have to deal in complex ideas. So I think of a song like yours, which I think is wonderful. Like you've got many great songs, but What If You Knew, which has some fantastic lyrics, but I don't think it would work as a poem because it doesn't leave us to work those things out. It runs at speed instead and presents us with things. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop, the major shoes. It's like brilliant lyrics. It works fantastically. That line might work in a poem, but generally speaking, the song tells us something rather than leaving us open to working it out. And that's maybe a fundamental difference often between poetry for the page and sometimes performance poetry and song, which I kind of think go together more in that sort of way. I mean, I'm talking a lot of horseshit here, but there's something in it.
No, that I think it's. I mean, I often say, actually, that the best way to talk about anything in terms of lyrics or I'd say poetry is generally you don't tell people what you think or what you feel, but you describe things that lead people to those. But the thing is,
what I
say that. Right, but from your perspective, that's not necessarily what I'm doing in my songs, and I totally see that because I mean it's all a matter of degree, you know, and because I mean you can be even much more in your face than my stuff is, you know, like you can be much more expressing your opinions and your thoughts even you know to a much greater degree than I do in my music, to the point where it would you know basically turn off all but the most fanatical listeners, you know. but it's a matter of
subtlety matters. Subtlety is really important, and I think generally speaking, but also like so is just anger or resentment or those things. They're all valid, but like you know, you don't want if you like chili, it doesn't mean you want a bowl of chilies, right? You know,
right?
Like,
exactly.
Yeah. So so there's gradation to those things.
Have you know, in terms of that last poem and other poems that you've written on the subject, I mean, like, have you thought about, which I know you have, but being born in 1981, which was a very, to anybody with a passing familiarity with history, that's a very auspicious year to be born in Belfast. And, regardless of your family situation, it's not at all a surprising year to be, you know, soon after that leaving Belfast and moving to Lincolnshire. But I would say that basically the entire population of Belfast in 1981 were trauma survivors.
Yeah.
And have you thought about that? That your inheritance of multi-generational trauma, even though you didn't grow up in Belfast, but just being from Belfast?
There'd be something vicarious about it if I said I did in some ways, because I didn't grow up there, and my parents are. Well, they're English. I mean, there may be my dad's ancestry is entirely Irish, but I don't think that counts for anything. If you think that blood defines your characteristics, then, you know, oh, he's like that because he's Irish. He's like that because he's Italian.
Oh, he didn't grow up in Belfast, your father?
It's a very short step from that to he's like that because he's a Jew. Do you know what I mean? It's like, do you know what I mean? Like bloodlines don't. So he...
But he didn't grow up in Belfast during
he didn't. He moved. Well, no, he no. It's so he was born in 1940 in London.
There's trauma. there's plenty of trauma to go around.
Oh yeah, no yeah.
So he was he was born. So the first few years of his life, bombs were falling on his city.
Oh yeah, like my grandmother, his mother, once shielded the pram on the street because there was a raid and things like that. Yeah. He had a sort of Mickey Mouse gas mask and stuff like that.
They made gas masks for kids with cartoon characters back.
Yeah.
Then?
Make them look less frightening. But if you see one in a museum, fuck me, they're frightening. Like, you know, can you imagine?
It's all a matter of degree.
I'll take my chances, mum. Do you know what I mean?
At least it's not like a skull painted on it or something.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they had cots as well, didn't they? They had like little incubator cot things with pipes coming out of them, which were like gas mask, well, sort of gas containers, I guess. Or like, I suppose not gas containers, the precise opposite. But you know what I mean? Like little baby shielding things as well. But yeah, so he moved to Ireland in 1968, I think, to work at the University of Ulster, the new University of Ulster, teaching English. And he at first he lived in Derry. And he lived very close. He lived on one of the streets that runs along the side of the Bogside.
In 68?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's got plenty of opportunity to be exposed to a hell of a lot of trauma. I mean, absolutely. I would say whether or not you actually were, you know, grew up in it, it's like clearly he grew up with a lot of trauma.
So, and yeah, then, so he did.
Like,
so
I know a guy in the Netherlands who is officially considered to be a second generation war trauma survivor because his grandfather was so traumatized by the occupation of the Netherlands, you know.
Right, yeah.
And this has been, you know, it's passed on in a way that's, you know, widely acknowledged by, you know, psychologists and, you know, and the Dutch state.
Yeah, of course.
You can get benefit for that.
Yeah. But no, he was living in on the edge of the Bogside when the Battle of the Bogside happened in 69, right? So he walked around like a reporter or something taking pictures. So he has the most amazing collection of photographs from the back. I've never seen anything else like it. And they're just in his house. I was born in 1981. And by then he was living in Coleraine. So we lived in Coleraine, which is in County Derry, but just like a third the way towards Belfast, really. That's where the new University of Ulster was set up, because even though Derry should have had a university, it was a majority Catholic city and Coleraine was majority Protestant. And then all of a sudden Coleraine gets the university, right? So, so they had a campus at McGee, and I think that's where my dad in Derry, and that's where my dad was. But then after that, they were in Coleraine. So yeah, I was born in 1981. When I was two, my parents separated. So I'd go over there a lot as a child. I'd spend a lot of time over there. I had friends over there. I'd spend most of my holidays there. And, so yeah, that was all very, very familiar to me, but it was also absolutely not where I was from, you know. But I do remember when a bomb went off in Coleraine in 1993, I think. And I remember that and calling up to make sure he was all right. And it had broken his front windows, even though it was half a mile away. Trauma? No, I mean, I can't. I was living in rural Lincolnshire, bored off my tits, wondering where life was, you know, like that's what I was mainly doing. So,
although, yeah, there's so many. Yeah, the question of trauma. I was talking to somebody who's doing a PhD in trauma a couple of weeks ago. So it's on my mind.
Oh, yeah, right. But, yeah.
Could you do another poem for
us? It's real. I just don't want to. I don't want to take any vicarious kind of.
The personal trauma and multi-generational trauma are different things, but both very real, I'd say.
Yeah. Sure. 100%. But the most traumatic thing that happened to me personally was being called an English cunt. Mind my French, Germanic. Which I didn't particularly enjoy, but it's not exactly, it's not really trauma, is it? You know?
Too dramatic.
It's true, David, as well, to be honest.
And you are English. You sound very English, unmistakably.
Not much I can do about it. speaking of which, right, so where I grew up was, sorry, this is a lead into a poem. It's not a non sequitur. Maybe it is, we'll see. But where I grew up was, it's very flat. Rural Lincolnshire is mainly very flat. It's on the east of England, about halfway up. And it's a rural agricultural county for the most part, and quite conservative and little villages and, you know, that sort of thing. And it's also full of RAF bases. So in the, lots of them predate the Second World War, but then in the Second World War, there were loads more. There's one actually in the village nearest to where I grew up, RAF Metheringham, which ran for about 4 years or something and then ceased operations, and the runways are roads, you know, it's great. One of those bases is RAF Waddington, which is really big. It's just south of Lincoln, about 3 or 4 miles out of the city, which is a very small city, cathedral city.
And this is the Royal Air Force for those.
The Royal Air Force, yeah, indeed. Sorry, the Royal Air Force. So the RAF operate a number of bases still in Lincolnshire, probably a higher concentration there than anywhere else in the country. And Waddington is now where they, I forgot what the unit's called, but it's where they operate the Reaper drones. So there's this building. I don't actually know which one. There are these kind of newer concrete buildings, and I assume it's in one of those. And that's where people pilot Reaper drones. So, yeah, I used to bike out there and sometimes watch the planes coming in and that sort of thing when I was a kid, because, like I said, there's really nothing else to do around there. And I was back there again a couple of years ago, and I wrote this poem. I read at an after-dinner speech. This is the epigraph to the poem. The poem's called Reaping, but the epigraph comes from Air Marshal Greg Bagwell, who at an after-dinner speech, retired now, said this to the assembled people. He said, "We need to test harder whether we can take a young 18 or 19-year-old out of their PlayStation bedroom and put them into a Reaper cabin and say, 'Right, you've never flown an aircraft before. That does not matter. You can operate this.'" Mm. Here's the poem. 18 or 19, what was I doing then? Well, one day I biked here to RAF Waddington's viewing point, from where I saw no action, called by the urgent tornadoes which had skimmed our village, shocking pliant heads at intervals of my childhood, and must have come from somewhere. Runway approach lights have switched on and point skywards at nothing coming in. A pigeon, a slip of moon. A screech owl would be too apposite, but I saw one once a mile from here on Bloxholme Lane. It stalled a moment, then beat on past the hedges, tall as houses, living its purpose, suddenly beyond range. And who knows what they do in a concreted cube 200 yards behind wires and warning signs, or who does it, or why, an inch from where it would have died, a sandfly fills its nest. Grasses by the road dip like a million rods to a million tiny catches. A saloon half a mile off indicates only to the clouding dusk, slows to corner the perimeter on a red route B road to home. Nothing to do but follow at a generous distance.
You're tuned to Discussions with David, which goes out live most weekdays at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and elsewhere. You can find it in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics on any podcasting platform, as well as at patreon.com/DavidRovics and at davidrovics.com. I feel so professional when I make commercial announcements like that.
You sound it. Sorry, a door's just swung open. Do you mind if I go in? This is very unprofessional. Do you mind if I go and shut it?
Right. No, we don't mind the noise of the traffic.
I'll be right back.
We are talking with Rory Waterman, lecturer at Nottingham Trent University and poet who has various books of poetry, including a very recent one.
Sorry,
Rory. Did you have tour plans for this book of poetry that were dashed by the pandemic?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's probably not in the same way that you did. Obviously, it would have been, you know, very different matter for you. Whole tours internationally. For me, normally I'd be doing a number of readings at festivals, that sort of thing. Around the launch of a book, I've done two. Two readings this time, both online. Yeah. I suppose, I mean, I'm speaking to a bookshop in LA next week. That wouldn't have happened.
So that, there's a little silver lining there to these really international gigs that you wouldn't have had otherwise, but a lot fewer gigs overall.
There's kind of a pewter lining on a ginormous rain cloud, you know, but like the rain's kind of poo on you. But the truth is that's not the main way I earn my bread, right? So
luckily,
I am so lucky. Right. I really am at the moment. I have no reason to complain. No one I know has got ill, touch wood. Right. I have a job. I know people who've lost their jobs or just haven't had the work and who've been in all sorts of trouble. I just have no, compared to most people, I've got no reason to complain. And yeah, okay. So it's a terrible time to have a book out. So what, you know?
Yeah.
People have it a lot worse. Almost everyone has it worse than I do in this. Not almost everyone, but a hell of a lot of people.
Yeah, at least a good 99% anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
90. Yeah. 95? Yeah.
You're in the ballpark here, yeah, right? So I just can't complain. But yeah, okay. So it's not a good time to have a book out. And I've lost a few readings, I'm sure, and the money that comes with that. It's not a big deal for me. It's okay. I hope the book doesn't sink. You know, it seems to be selling all right.
People are finding out about it somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I've got two books behind me, and they did all right. So I think that makes a big difference. You know, I think it would be a bad time to have a debut with no fanfare. But
some of the recent poems have been published in popular newspapers as well. Does that probably help?
Stuff like that, yes. Yeah. So there was one in The Guardian and I've had poems in The New Statesman and, you know, various poetry magazines, Poetry Review, which is the biggest of the poetry magazines here probably, and other places like that, The Times Literary Supplement. I've been quite well served, really. So, you know, maybe it's had a bit of an effect on the number of readings I've had, but you know, that's the worst thing that's happening in my life at the moment. I am one lucky boy, you know, so.
It definitely beats a ventilator. Yeah.
Yeah. It beats a ventilator, doesn't it? I'm keeping a close eye on what's going on in your country as well at the moment.
Yeah,
I don't trust a thing that our government says about coronavirus. I haven't, you know, they're not transparent. That, you know, we know that they're liars and crooks and shysters, and Boris Johnson's gone fucking missing again. Which at least makes me not want to punch my television, you know, but like,
he's gone missing. Yeah. Is he,
well, he just sort of, no, well, who knows? I mean, he just sort of vanishes every now and then. I'm a bit like, you know, Uncle Donald. He doesn't really want the job, it seems like, you know. Right. And it is interesting how, I guess this has been said a lot of times, but the US, the UK, the two countries who've really, really suffered with this. And yeah, okay, there are reasons that are beyond the control, that there are vagaries of, you know, possibility and all those sorts of things. But all the same, they're probably possibly the two hardest hit countries, along with maybe
Brazil,
Belgium, for a different set of reasons, really. And when you look at the United Kingdom and the USA and Brazil, they're all led by kind of shysters, aren't they? They're all led by like, you know, what we call populists who really aren't. Yeah, con men. That's right. People who are, who don't have any principles whatsoever. Yeah, it's just a really interesting phenomenon that's what's happening.
Especially in the two Western countries that have done the most in terms of like getting rid of the vestiges of social democracy and austerity budgets and stuff. And you look at at least the countries in the West that used to have welfare states, and you know, the US is principal among them, and in terms of Europe, definitely the UK has done the most to gut social spending, you know, at least in Northern Europe. You know,
it's shameful, but one thing that, of course, you have, I don't know how lucky this is actually, because I mean, Joe Biden's such a sort of milquetoast candidate, but you have the chance to get rid of the most egregious leader in the Western world, right? this
year. Well, we'll see about that. I mean, I know you're still living there with an expat from the US and
we have 5 years. Yeah. We have five years. We have years of this, and by then people are quick to forget. And
see if there's going to be an election in November. What do you guys think?
I don't know. I mean, like American politics, in a way, we view it a bit like sport, don't we? It's sort of like happening a long way away, but at the same time, it affects us so much as well, and affects so many of the things that we care about too. And everything that happens in the US seems to end up being sort of implanted here, whether it's kind of for the better or the worse, right? So, what do I think? I mean, I as far as I can tell, obviously he'd love to stop it, wouldn't he? But it doesn't seem like he can. What difference will it make? Why would anyone vote for Joe Biden, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's part of the scary thing too, is that he's certainly not exactly inspiring of any kind of, you know.
Look, he was the one there to make Obama look good. That was his role, wasn't it? It's like he was the vice president to make the president look good, you know,
and to now make sure that the president looked more moderate and less scary.
That's
we
right.
got an old and, white guy here
and witty and interesting. And now it's just fucking him. It's just him. It's like anyway, we'll see. We'll see. It's not going to be the wonderful kind of social change that people think it's going to be. I don't think at all.
No,
of course,
sadly.
It's not. He's just a corporate shill like the rest of them.
Yeah, and of course, you know, people had such hope in Obama, and most recently, and that was completely dashed by everybody's rent doubling around here, among other things. But,
and I know, and you've been quite active on that front, and
it's hard to avoid
right.
when your rent doubles. You know, it gets you passionate about these things.
Sort of piques your interest.
When all your neighbors have their rent doubled too, it's like,
we haven't quite had that, but rent and house prices have gone up a lot here. And I mean,
in Nottingham or particularly in
nationwide,
London, Bristol,
I mean,
nationwide.
Nottingham's a relatively inexpensive city for a major city, which it is by British standards. It's relatively inexpensive, but
because as the tabloid press likes to point out, it has it's the stabbing capital of England, right? Isn't that what they love to call Nottingham? Which hopefully keeps the real estate prices down.
Yeah, they can say it more if they want. It used to be called Shottingham, which is quite nice. I mean, I think the gun crime rates would be like, you know, a tenth what they'd be in any American city, but apparently
less.
Shottingham was what it was, and it has sort of, you know, gang crime problems, or allegedly does, and
allegedly.
To some extent will do. I mean, it's a major city, isn't it? So, but it's a great city. I love it.
And
but,
a post-industrial city as well. Major.
I think that's the right way of phrasing it. Yeah. It's not completely died in the way that some have. And it's a thriving city, but post-industrial. I mean, I don't know if you've read the novel Saturday Night and Sunday Morning by Alan Sillitoe.
No, recommend it?
Oh, mate. Oh, yeah, 100%. It's Alan Sillitoe, Sillitoe, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. So it's written in the 1950s. And it's about a bike, someone who works at the Rally bike factory, bicycle factory. And that was in Nottingham. And there was basically Nottingham made bikes and cigarettes. So you could kind of like fill your lungs with clean air and then kind of destroy them with tar afterwards, you know. But
nice.
But it's all gone. Of course, it's all gone, you know. Mm-hmm. But it is quite a thriving city. But house prices have gone up nationwide to the point where, and in some cities like London, or even anywhere near it, you know, all the towns around there and other cities in the south like Bristol. God, you can't buy a house unless you've got lots of capital, unless mummy and daddy can give you a lot of money, right? So, I mean, we're still renting in Nottingham. So, yeah, I can't afford to buy a house. I'm a senior lecturer. Partly that's my own fault, but, you know.
If you become like a full professor or something, then maybe you make enough to buy a house or... No.
Well, no. I'm not quite being honest. I mean, I guess I make enough to buy a house, but
if you wanted to really bond yourself to Nottingham and to the bank and paying mortgage for 30 years,
correct. Yeah, but it's just a very different prospect to what it was a generation ago.
Yeah.
So you know, kids go to university. They come out of university. They can't get a job. They're never going to get on the property ladder or anything like that. You don't have to have a political conscience to be angry about that. And a lot of them don't, and they don't really know why they're angry. You know, they don't know the systems in place that precipitate.
They don't know what
it was
like before, right? They don't know how much easier it was before, and they're stuck
in a situation.
And they don't even know why they're so angry. I was thinking about that, and just in terms of your own experiences. I mean, of course, you're teaching at a university, and of course, being a poet for a living has never been much of a option, for most people in most societies, right? But you also have been, your career also began with the collapse of the publishing industry and the music industry.
Oh yeah, fair enough. I mean, the poetry publishing industry is always a cottage industry, right?
That's right. So right? There's never really been a poetry publishing industry, but the rest of the publishing, the broader publishing industry sort of collapsed during your tenure as a poet, basically.
Yeah, it's this bit, but in some ways, but obviously with music, I mean, I think you're not putting out CDs anymore, actually, from now on. Is that right? Yeah.
No point. Yeah. I mean, books at least don't require batteries or book players. So I think there's a little more, a little more longevity.
Yeah. I see the point there. But obviously this, I've kind of watched this kind of, I guess, sort of revolution sort of happen in music. And it hasn't really happened in publishing in the same way, not in poetry publishing at all. So I don't know how well my particular press does. It's one of what is sometimes called the big five poetry presses in Britain. But that doesn't mean much in terms. It's not like the big four banks or anything. It's got a staff of six, I think. And they're wonderful, and they look after me very well. And I'm perfectly happy with that. And I have a superb editor and that sort of thing. I don't know, because maybe they're like a duck serene on the top and paddling away like Billy-O underneath. I don't know, but I don't think there's that much of a difference in poetry publishing. Some magazines have gone online, that sort of thing. It's really not the same as in your industry. And I suppose that's another thing that's happened with you, is that CD sales have gone through the floor, right? Purchasing of hard copies of music. So you make money from shows, right? And then there aren't any.
Basically. I mean, that's the situation, and anyway, for a whole lot of performers.
Of course, across the board. But it's not really affected poetry. But then there wasn't much money in there in the first place. So I don't know.
For those people who are watching, and I imagine there's more than a handful who are songwriters and poets and people who have done various creative efforts, just in terms of publishing books of poetry where you're actually working with an editor, with my limited experience with publishing and working with an editor, it can be an amazing process that can vastly improve everything that you're doing if it's a good editor. And I don't know,
right,
can you share any experiences of working with an editor?
Yeah, I can. So there's an American poet called Nicholas Friedman. So he's not an editor, but we share everything with each other. So he lives in Syracuse, New York. And he's a very good friend of mine, Nicholas Friedman. He's definitely worth looking up. And we've shared pretty much everything for 12, 13 years, and kind of knocked 10 bells out of it for each other, and send each other back to the drawing board quite often. But my editor at Carcanet, Michael Schmidt, he's been there since the beginning. And he suggested with this book, which is my new one, Sweet Nothings, the book's in two sections. And I was quite wedded to the second section's kind of got more of the weightier poems in it. And the first one's kind of a bit more, I have a bit more fun, if you like. There are a few more poems with characters and that sort of thing. A disenfranchised academic who's kind of an old fart, that sort of thing, and play with those characters a bit. And I had it so that those poems would be in the second half of the book. It would kind of end with the lighter poems, but sometimes they're quite angry, but the more kind of intentionally kind of witty or comical poems or whatever. He suggested reversing the order. And he's right. So it kind of, instead the book now ramps up, but that's entirely down to him. That wasn't my idea.
Yeah.
And it totally changes the texture of the whole book, because you want, if you write a book of poems, you want the reader to start at the beginning and end at the end, and they won't, right? Okay, that's taken as read, but at the same time, that's what you kind of hope for. So that's what I want to happen. a reader to begin at the beginning and end at the end. And some of the poems are not in sequences, but they kind of link together or kind of play with contradictions with each other. And so the order does really matter. And the two sections were ordered correctly within themselves, but they were the wrong way around. And I was kind of wedded to this idea of it beginning with a thump and then kind of lightening up. But no, he was totally right. So that's a huge impact for me anyway, that an editor had just by saying, I don't think you've got these the right way around.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah, and sometimes just other things where, you know, you've I can't really think of any specific examples, but
that's where I haven't one.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I'll leave it there then, because I'm sort of struggling to, I've got something on the edge of conscience, but you know.
Yeah, I know how it is, of course. Yeah. When, you know, you mentioned John Bain, Attila the Stockbroker, earlier, and one thing I was wondering, got sidetracked earlier, but I was wondering what, like his poetry, I mean, I think, first of all, he's a brilliant poet, right? And but his poetry really lends itself to being performed, and
absolutely,
that's certainly what he's been doing with it for the past 30 years or something. But why, I mean, but at the same time, though, although it's not like your poetry and a lot of other poetry that's not sort of performance oriented, it's still, it does all the same things to a listener, you know, in terms of having such an emotional impact when you hear it, you know, just, but maybe as much as when you read it, you know, at least. And I wonder what is this divide, and how did this, I mean, I see it around me since I was young, you know, but what is this divide between the performance poets and the non-performance poets? And, you know, how rigid is that line, and how did you end up on the non-performance side of the line, in a sense?
Well, I don't really know, because I quite like performing, you know, I quite
do
like
you?
Being
okay.
in front of people and that sort of thing. I mean, I love all of that. So
do you go to slams, or have you?
No, not in that way, but I used to, I mean, not very well, but I used to sing in a band. So I'm never, ever, ever going to let you hear a demo from what you did. But I've never had any problem with that. You know, I mean, I did when I was very small, and then I kind of, one day I just went, come on, Rory, just get on with it. And then realized that nerves are not something you need to, that I could overcome them, and it was much better when I did. I agree. I think John Attila, I think he's a really good poet. And of course he does write to be heard. I mean, some of his poems work on the page as well, but very well on the page as well, and in a slightly different way, because you get different nuances from them.
Yeah.
But I mean, even with me, like, I'll think very carefully about which poems, if I'm giving a reading, I'm not just going to, about half of the poems in the book, I probably would, or any of my books, I probably wouldn't choose to do at readings or anything like that. And most of the poems that I read, I know off by heart. So I end up kind of more or less performing them anyway. But yeah, some don't really work that way, because they require you to be able to see them and sort of think through aspects of them.
Part of it is visual, like the way it's laid out on the page.
Yeah, I guess so. And the same would be true for John's poems, I'm sure, right? To some extent. But I guess there's a different emphasis in his work to mine, and that's about all there is to it. He thinks, I guess, when we'd have to ask him, I'm talking for him, but I'd imagine he thinks very much about how things will come across in front of an audience. And I think more in terms of how things will come across to a reader.
Yeah.
But other than that, I don't think there's much of a difference. There's a slight difference. It's the same, you know, what is poetry? You know, it's kind of hard to define, isn't it? So maybe we're not quite doing the same sort of thing, but there's a great point of connection anyway.
Right.
I mean, he's definitely a poet, isn't he? So
one thing I noticed when I first started touring and performing in England is with John as well, but also just noticing beyond just with Attila, it's not uncommon in sort of various sort of music and poetry scenes in England to write serious poetry that rhymes. Whereas here in the US, it's completely unheard of, I would say. I mean, from my experience, I mean, that may have been, that's changed. But when I was younger anyway, and going to a lot of poetry slams and more open mics and more kind of in the performance scene, not that I was performing poems, but I was kind of more in the scene in Boston, and nobody did rhyming poetry.
No, well, it's hard, isn't it? Well, I'll come back to that in a second. One thing that I was going to say again about Attila, like vicariously talking on behalf of someone else, is like, of course, one of the main, or among the main figures that would have been an inspiration to that, I suppose, would have been people like John Cooper Clarke.
Yeah.
Who was obviously like a punk rock poet, right? Who would like open for punk bands and get covered in flob, you know, while he was like, you know what I mean? But it was very much part of the scene. And like, so the idea that the written and spoken word would be really important in that scene, it's not like, it's not alien territory to that. And I guess like he's an inspiration to me as well, but in a different way, you know, like, not necessarily directly to the art I do. And I don't know he is for him either, but anyway, so rhyming poetry, I guess in the, you know, in the rhyme and meter, like, you know, structured kind of metered poems. I mean, it can seem very kind of staid, can't it? And sometimes, and in America, there's this group of poets, the new formalists, who've been in existence for quite a while, and they tend towards the right. They tend to be sort of like a bit right wing and conservative as well in their attitudes to poetry, like, you know, and art generally. Like the magazine called New Criterion, which basically exists to say, you know, why are there so many immigrants, and why don't artists make sense anymore? And you know, that seems to be that just seems to be their shtick. And to some extent, new formalism is linked to that. Not entirely. I'm being very unfair because it's not a political ideology, but you can see how there's an inherent conservatism that would appeal, right?
Social conservatism, sort of.
Yeah, that's right. And traditionalism. And I'm interested in tradition, but I'm not interested in those other aspects of that. But I certainly believe in the strength of tradition, and things like sonnets, for example, I think can be very powerful because they carry all the things we expect a sonnet to do with them. And then you can play with what those things are. You can take them away and then subvert things. And because you're playing with a received form, you know,
right.
So you're kind of, it's like a palimpsest. Yeah. So there's a palimpsest you can create. So it's not a restriction. And there's a, you know, the great German poet, Rainer Maria Rilke, talks about, rhyme being the deity of very secret and ancient coincidences. And I love that. Like there's a kind of a quantum leap of sense between good rhymes, you know, because they chime, don't they? That's how you notice a rhyme. It's like it makes the same sound as it did before, you know. So you can play, it gives extra things to play with. So there's nothing to be scared of, but writing in meter can be quite difficult, and it can come across in quite a boring way. It's very good for being witty with, of course.
That's the thing,
you know,
right?
Sharp,
it's always good for that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Apart from anything else. But I mean,
but
like,
it,
you
can
know,
can be so much more.
Oh, a hell of a lot more. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, I really think so. And yeah, so I don't know if this is a particularly kind of wonderful answer, but I mean, I think it's a tool I want in my toolkit, but I don't always write in rhyme and meter, but when I do, it's to play with what that allows me to play with.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Did you do another one for us?
Yes, mate. Of course. Right. So this is from the previous book called Sarajevo Roses. And I've forgotten which one it was going to be. Okay. Driving through the pit village. So, yeah, there are three poems in, well, the title Sarajevo Roses implies a kind of focus on foreign places, foreign to here. And that is central to the book, and a Sarajevo rose was the mortar shell during the siege of Sarajevo. Of course, the city was shelled a lot, and a lot of these the holes were filled in with red resin as a memorial, and they were called Sarajevo roses. And often because of the shrapnel, you get kind of concentric rings of indents out from them, which are full of red resin now. And of course, as the city is very slowly rejuvenated, a lot of these are just being just going. But that's the texture of the book is mainly based around kind of ideas of, I guess, conflicts between people. But this poem's called Driving Through the Pit Town, and it's very much focused at home. And so where I live in Nottingham, just north of here, we've got the North Nottinghamshire coalfield. And he talked about post-industrial, and I said that Nottingham still thrives largely, which it sort of, relatively speaking, it does. But some of those towns up up to the north of here really do not. They're former mining towns, and they don't have a lot of industry, many jobs. And now, in the recent election, a lot of them have been convinced to vote for the Conservatives over Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, which, anyway, that's a different matter, and it's beyond the poem. But the poem's called Driving Through the Pit Town, and it's dated 2013, which is the year that Margaret Thatcher died. Driving Through the Pit Town. There's not much round here now, you say. Just huddled brick or pebble-dashed terraces and tiny new builds where the pit heads were. Bare hills fly up beyond the town you left, with clasps of scree, caps of sodden green pitched above the neat slate pitches, but your eyes stay on the road. The side streets jut left and right, so many of them, like ribs. You jab a finger. We lived up top of that one. Then, surprise, a pale sun picks at a slit in the paper sky. Yellow slaps down momently and slides along the valley, and the half a pit wheel trenched in the roundabout shimmers, red as flesh. We won't stop here. And most of the shops, kebab land, USA nails, Milan fashions, are shut or boarded anyway. The four lads pincering fags outside the co-op, gobbing and shoving, repulsed for what they are. It's no use knowing better, more, you say. And in blue spray paint, the back of the village sign cries ding dong, like we're waiting at a door.
You know, it strikes me that poems, I mean, there's poetry in the age of Twitter. They're kind of simpatico in a way, because you got it's a short form, and yet they're like totally opposite in another way, because Twitter, you think of it's multitasking and people doing, you know, looking at their feed while they're clicking on
something. I mainly think of Twitter as people like digging trenches to represent their position, like climbing into the trench and then lobbing grenades at each other. And that's pretty much all they do. Like, you know, and they're like, lads, you know, what do you think in the trench? Oh, you think that as well. Oh, what do you think? Oh, you think that as well. Well, let's not listen to those bastards. They've got a grenade, you know, and that's basically, that's Twitter.
That's really good. I kind of think of, I think of Facebook that way, but I guess, I mean, really all social media really has those characteristics.
But, yeah. I mean, at least Instagram's mainly just pretty pictures and stuff.
Yeah, they had it down, I think, limiting it to pictures, to making sure that you can't post anything unless it's a picture. That seems to have really helped with keeping people from just shouting at each other.
But they're all run by bastards, aren't they? There's no interest in, like, keeping us from doing those things. They want us to do those things. Unrest and then continued unrest and more of it, of course, is how they drive people to tweet more and therefore get more from advertising. It's all so obvious, and we're like... Yeah. We're so obviously geared up towards wanting to interact. We're a social species. We want to connect with people, right? We do inherently, and it's the only reason we're here. It's the only reason, like, I'm talking to you on this computer, is because people have kind of, it's because of collaboration, right? Humans coming together and working. I know there are many awful things people have done with these things, but the general desire to kind of like to know, to understand, and it requires collaboration, and it's the only reason we've done it. It's the only reason we're not kind of like making fire in caves, right? And can build on the knowledge we have collectively. And I've completely forgotten what my point is, but anyway, Twitter is like, and all social media platforms work by making us not want to collaborate, really, I think, or only to collaborate within a small group and not to see commonality and then understand and discuss difference, but to go to war, you know. It just drives more advertising. It allows for more of that analysis. That's all it is. And horrendous. Anyway, I totally walked over your point. What were you saying?
No, sorry. That was exactly it. No, I like it. No, that was, I was looking for your analysis on social media in the age of poetry in the age of social media, or just social media in general. And I got
it's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of, like, when you see the poet with the business card thing, you know, like the business card in the handshake kind of thing, but the Twitter equivalent of that is kind of obvious, you know. And like there's when you see people kind of marketing themselves so aggressively, selling their brand, I mean, it just looks a bit sad to me in the world of poetry, where that you know, that I totally understand the need to sell your product, but sometimes in the world of poetry, it just feels like there's a lot of ego, a lot of signaling of virtue without really meaning anything.
Although if I were a haiku poet, I think I'd be excited about Twitter, you know.
Oh, mate, absolutely.
It would be perfect for posting a daily haiku. I mean, I know a guy in Tokyo who writes a haiku every day. He visits a different cemetery every day and writes a poem about it. And it's fantastic stuff.
I like the idea of doing that every day. A friend of mine, Andrew Taylor, wrote tweet length poems, the length of a tweet, every day for about 4 months, and then published it as a pamphlet. They are genuinely cool. But he did this. He wrote them when the Twitter character limit was 140, and then they doubled it before he published it. So, if you were the haiku poet wanting to publish on Twitter, you'd probably be a bit annoyed they'd ramped up their character count. So you could do a tanker or something.
After you've worked so hard to limit to make your form of art constrict to these parameters, which is kind of an exciting thing to try to do, I find, to like try to work within strict parameters. It's
I think that's the point, right? And you're doing that every time you write a song, aren't you? Because, like, you know, you have to stick within the structure of that song.
Yeah.
Right. So that's going back to the meter thing. That's kind of how I think about meter. Like, having that restriction doesn't limit you and make your song worse. It kind of, like, it tightens what you're trying to say.
Absolutely.
It forces you to work on that trajectory
defeat you, if you don't get defeated by the meter, like, I mean, defeated by the restriction, like, you can just, okay, 100%. I'll just do a forced rhyme here because I have to do something that ruins the whole thing. You can't.
Yeah, because there are bad artists everywhere, right? But I mean, like, I've never heard a lyric of yours that does that, you know. But like, you'd have rejected lots of things because of that. But that's right. What climbs over the hill, like, is worth it, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Rory, thank you so much for joining me for the hour. It's been a great pleasure.
Pleasure. It's been really nice. Yeah. You too, mate. You too. Yeah.
Hope to see you in England sometime after the pandemic. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, next time you are here, I'll I used to enjoy driving you around every now and then to things, I just got too busy to, and it just didn't work out. But you can put me on driving duty again, David. I'd be happy to help.
Excellent. Take care, Rory.
Cheers, mate. Take care.
Cheers. And thanks for tuning into this conversation with Rory Waterman in Nottingham. You can find all of these discussions archived in various places, including on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/drovix in the Discussions with David playlist. You'll also find them all in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovix on any podcasting platform, or just go to davidrovix.com. If you want to support my broadcasting efforts, you are most welcome to become a patron at patreon.com/davidrovix, where all these broadcasts are also available for anyone to download, along with some patron-only offerings as well. If you're in the Portland area, please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up to receive text notifications so you can be part of Portland Emergency Eviction Response when the investment banks that own half of this city start trying to evict so many of our neighbors. If you want to help make my next album a multi-instrumental success, check out davidrovix.com/pandemic sessions. Remember, don't pay the rent, don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.